Okay. My name is Francina Turner, and I'm interviewing Bobby McLeod for the Reparative Histories and a Black Experience at UMD Oral History Project. Mr. McLeod, I want to start first with what is your hometown?
Well, I'm from Washington, D.C. And I, when I graduated from high school, Roosevelt High School, I went to college in South Dakota for 2 years on a football scholarship.
Okay. What is your birthday?
April 28, 1947.
Okay. So I know that you were transferred into Maryland, but if you could talk to me a little bit about your life prior to coming to UMD in terms of like your family composition, your home community, thoughts on education, that kind of thing.
Yeah. My mother and father met and married in Washington, D.C. Seven kids. We lived on, actually, when we moved on, we lived on Jefferson Street. We were, I think there was one of the Black family that moved on that block. And so at the high school, the elementary school that I went to, I don't think I had any Black teachers when I started. There are more equal Blacks and white in the school. So it was that kind of upbringing. We were in a middle-class type of neighborhood. My father was an engineer with GSA in the federal government. My mother stayed at home. We had some advantages in our neighborhood. The deputy mayor, which was a Black guy, lived not a couple of blocks down. Doctors, lawyers lived in the neighborhood. So it was that kind of environment, upbringing for me.
Okay. So was attending college sort of a foregone conclusion for you and your siblings? Or did you feel you had a choice of whether you wanted to go
back? Yeah, I wanted to, but I knew I wanted to go to college. My father was also a minister, and he was a hardworking guy. And so we weren't, and but my mother, they were both from North Carolina, but we weren't really sat down and said, well, you know, here's how you develop your life and develop your goal plans and, you know, so forth. You go to college, you get good grades, and then you study, that type of thing. I sort of grew up on watching my friends and neighbors and what was going on. So when I was in high school, I seemed to have a pretty good life. Teachers seemed to have seen something in me there. They helped me. I don't know if I was just showing, I was just trying to do more. I wanted more or just what. I don't know what they saw, but I took advantage of whatever opportunities were given me. And I didn't know. I wanted to go to college because all my friends wanted to go to college, but I didn't know what it took to get there. And I knew I didn't have money to get there. So I had to play football. So and junior high, I started playing in the playgrounds. Bots got a little name, went to trial for a high school team, got cut. But that made me more determined. So I didn't get on in that same season. My high school coach was a white coach. And he was determined to try to get as many of his team members, guys that played for him, in school. And he was very successful at that. I had around two or three offers. One was to Boston University. And I decided that's where I wanted to go. And they filled out the applications, transcripts, to the request of the council, high school counselor's office. And the Alumni Association of Boston started entertaining me, taking me out, yada, yada, building my head up. And I just felt great. I was going to be their starting center. And then I found in late July, early August, I got a notice from Boston that they had not received my transfer of grades, you know, official transcripts. And when we checked into it, the counselor at my high school, he apologized, he admitted it's alcoholism, and they just didn't send it, so I couldn't go to Boston. And it was very heartbreaking, but the school had, my high school had some other schools that were late entry applicants. And so the school out in South Dakota, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, they were interested. I had, you know, I accepted, you know, right away. They thought they were getting a, you know, some big deal that was going to go to Boston University. And here this guy was going to go to this small college in South Dakota, Baptist School. It's now a university, Sioux Falls University. And so they were very happy about that. And when my father went up with me, I guess they sent him some money or something. I don't know. You know, there was some deal there because my father never, you know, he didn't have time to do anything and money to do anything. So we took the train up there. When I got off the train, the school band was there, the school president, everybody, the mayor, and this type of thing. And they put my father up in a hotel, being a dorm, and it was a big deal. So there was one other black kid from there from Nebraska. He was my roommate. I don't know how much you want in detail.
Go ahead. No, this is what I want.
He was an interesting fellow. He grew up in the Midwest, Nebraska, in a small town, and he'd never been around black people. A great number, other than his brother. He had a brother. Mm-hmm. His brother later became a lieutenant, a general, a head of NASA. He's now a lieutenant in NASA. But his name is Jose Bolton. He's a black guy. He's Jewish, Hispanic name. And I just thought, and he'd never been around black people. He couldn't dance or anything. He had no rhythm. It was funny to me. It was comical. He was comical to me, and I was intriguing to him. So we got along very well. We talked even today. So, and it was a different environment for me. I'd never been around an environment like in South Dakota. It's just totally different. Then it was a Baptist college, too. I'm not, my father was a minister, but that was his thing. That was not my thing. Mm-hmm. And so it was interesting. It's a very good experience. I did very well out there. Athletically and academically, not bad. The first year, after I finished my, you know, we won the conference. I got all conference honors and all that type of thing. So I contacted Boston and they said, "Yeah, come on over." You know, so I again transcripts had to go over Sioux Falls. You know, I was supposed to send transcripts over. Finally, Boston said, "Well, yeah, where the transcript?" I said, "That's supposed to be sent over." They did not send them over. They did not want me to go. I was really pissed off, and I told the dean and everybody, and they admitted it. You know, so they made a deal with me. They gave, I mean, I could do anything in that school I wanted to. We didn't live in a dorm. There was not a co-ed dorm. Girls, I was the only room that girls could come into, to come and go as we please. I had a car. I had an account downtown with the clothing, gas. And on Saturdays, the cafeteria was closed. But me and my buddies ate at an alumni's house, steak, whatever we had, breakfast, lunch, dinner. Mm-hmm. And so that crazy kind of thing. And I thought that was great. They even brought in some more black students. They brought in two guys from my high school football team. And but that's next year. I again would try for Boston. Boston said, "Okay, yeah, come on." But I had a friend of mine in the administration's office get the transcript and send it. And they sent it, I said, send it to Boston and send it to the University of Maryland. Mm-hmm. And so when I talked to Boston, they said they had taken a center from my high school. And mm-hmm. so I said, well, look, let me just go to University of Maryland and I'll play there. So I went out, got to Maryland, tried out for the team. And Bob Ward was the coach. Made an offer to give me a half start scholarship. And I said, well, you know, I can't really play for free or part scholarship. I need full scholarships. This school was more expensive than the last school. Mm-hmm. So when he said that, and I realized I just had to pay my way, then I just backed out. And so for the first time in my high school and college career, I had time on my hands to get involved in other things, and other kids, because I would always be, you know, football takes a lot of your time, but student activities the other part of the time. And I always wondered what everybody else was doing and stands and all of that and everything. And so now I had some time on my hands, and this was the time when I met, I saw a guy walking down University of Maryland campus, and I didn't know who he was, but looked real sharp, had on some fantastic shoes, dressed real nice, had a great walk with him, a nice smile. He introduced himself to me. He said, "You're Bob McLeod." I said, "Well, yeah, who are you?" He said, "I'm Earl Wynn." And he, well, because there weren't that many blacks here, you know, when somebody came in, they knew who it was, what was going on. He was founder and head of Congress of Racial Equality on campus core. And I liked that guy. He was an intriguing kind of guy, you know, a leader type. You could definitely tell, somebody I respected and loved from the beginning. He and I are friends and type, really, right, even to this very day. And so I started to talk to him, and we started to talk about things. Met another friend, Bob Blanford, and he and Blanford had an apartment on Rhode Island Avenue. And even though I had a dorm room, I would hang out in their place most of the time. We'd just be talking about the core and that type of thing. And I became a public relations manager, director of core. Became active in that organization. And the Diamondback, there's quite a bit of articles about CORE and this activities there. But you need to talk to Earl. He can give you a great deal of information and detail about all of that that went on. He had a struggle, and he was instrumental in getting bringing that struggle to light. He challenged the president of the university directly, got responses, a lot of times negative responses, but he got response. And he deserves a lot of credit for where things are today. At the time that, you know, we were doing activities with CORE, you know, we realized, let me tell you, you have to understand something. The University of Maryland College Park campus was never for Black people. Mm-hmm. Never was, never going to be. You know that already. I guess I'm telling history, but you already know. Eastern Shore, you stay there. That's where you go. No problem, even though we had to do that. They did not want our students on the College Park campus. A few, as a result of legal action, started to come in. Mm-hmm. And you probably have the names of some of them. But, you know, even though that was the case, they still had restrictions on other places, okay? They allowed students from Maryland to come to the College Park campus. Mm-hmm. But if you were from D.C., you could not get in. So when I was accepted, I was surprised, you know? Really, I just said, you know, if I can't go to Boston, I got to go somewhere, and I can't go to Howard because I'd be trying to be socializing too much, so we just go to Maryland, which is the closest in. And I got accepted. And the University of Maryland, there were a number of Black kids at that time, maybe 1,000 on campus, that lived 1,000, maybe 1,500. with those that were off campus, maybe another 2,000. And, you know, there was not a lot of socializing, not a lot of contact. You see a Black person and you expect them to look at you and say hi, some, they keep their head down and go the other way, you know, avoid you because they wanted to be a part of, they wanted to be accepted. That's why when Earl, you know, approached me, you know, I was so pleased. I mean, he responded just like a person would in a normal setting, you know, Black person, hey brother, how you doing? How what's going on? And I appreciated that. So that's how he and I became tight. But the problem with the University of Maryland's Blacks on campus at that time was that there was a lot of indifference. Earl was a dynamic person. And so a lot of people followed that dynamic person. Not a lot, but enough for him to be encouraged and take activity. And as Black people, as he took activity, the Black folks began to follow him. They didn't necessarily believe in it, but they followed it. And that's a difference. And I mean, if he wanted to do something strong and powerful, then it would have been problematic. Because, you know, they just wanted to be seen, but not be a part of, if you can understand what I mean. And we understood that. So, but at the same time, all across the United States around that time, there was another movement going on, Black awareness. People were becoming aware. People were becoming a part of. Blacks were identifying, Blacks were joining together. And there's a difference between what was going on at Howard University, at Morgan University, and what was going on at the University of Maryland and Penn State. You know, what was happening with the Black people in the major colleges where we are the minority, you know, in that school, and really more like the example of of society. How do we survive and exist? And University of Maryland's attitude was just total ignore you. Articles in the Diamond Bark were mostly before Earl, and a lot of times during his administration, you know, was insignificant. Didn't mention Black people unless it's something negative happened. Really not even at that. There were no Black writers. There were very few professors. I don't know of any. Maybe there were, but I don't know of any at the time when I was there. Maybe there were, but I don't know. It's a big school. And so we were determined to try to turn some of that stuff around. And with this Black movement that was going across the United States, we decided that there was four of us. Me, Earl Wynn, Bob Blanford, and Josie Bass. I could give you contact with Bob Blanford and Earl Wynn, but we cannot find Josie. We decided to change the name to the Black Student Union, CORE, Congress of Racial Equality, to the Black Student Union.
Before we get to that part, I have a couple of questions that if I don't ask you, I'm going to forget. Okay. What year did you enter UMD?
That's a good question. Hold on a second. I was just looking at it.
Okay.
I think I came in the fall of 67.
Okay. And what part of North Carolina are your parents from?
My mother's from North Wilkesboro. My father's from a place called Rayford, which is not far from Fayetteville.
Yep, and I'm in Fayetteville. Okay.
You're in Fayetteville? All right.
Yep,
I live. So you know, well, I say Rayford, you know, we're related, right?
Exactly.
He's from a town called BOMO. Mm-hmm. I know you probably haven't heard of that.
You said BOMO?
BOMO.
So it's near.
That was a little the community that the McLeods and the McEachins lived in. Mm-hmm. You know, we're all on the same plantation. I can give you history of all of that. The McLeods and the Keechans were cousins, and they were all part of the same plantation. And the McLeods and Keechans, and there was another McLeods in South Carolina that was part of the Mary McLeod Bethune. She married a McEachin.
Oh.
Well, she married a McEachin. Something like that. I don't know. I have to go back on it, but it's all history. Okay, go ahead. Other questions.
What was your major when you came on campus?
Business.
Business. Okay. Now, I do want to know, did you have more to say about your major? I didn't know if I
No.
Okay. I do want to know, so you were a member of CORE before you all changed the name to the Black Student Union.
Yeah, I was one of the officers of CORE.
Okay. What went in, so I think that's where you were about to go before I so ungraciously interrupted you, but what went into the decision-making process to change the name?
Yeah, well, there were more Blacks coming to the university. There were more Blacks coming with a different attitude and stride to the university. And, you know, we wanted to, cater to that group, but not lose those folks that have been following us before. So Earl was the headstone of that. And we wanted to bring in a different consciousness to what we were doing and what was going on across the United States. And so we felt that the conversion from the name of CORE, which represented Congress or racial equality, I mean, that could mean anything and everybody and all inclusive and everything else. And that was fine for them, but what we want to do is focus on Black people, Black students, focus on that, because we have some things to build. And so we decided to change the name to the Black Student Union. But it was really CORE, and Earl was the president of CORE. So we changed the name to Black Student Union. So he was the first president of the Black Student Union. And we decided at the end of the year to have an election, and I was elected. It was a setup, but I knew I was going to be president, and I knew it was going to be some trouble. So we elected this real smart guy to be Woody Farrar to be my vice president, because we were having, we knew what we were creating under CORE, and we knew what we were going to create under the Black Student Union. And we had also a way of approach with the new Black Student Union. Earl was sort of, he's a fiery speaker. He can get you fired up and really mad. Bob Blanford would then come on and speak, and he would throw a lot of historical African brothers history, this and that, boom, boom, the bam, boom. And Josie would come and bring it all around to a swinging point and get the crowd, we're talking to Black students, fired up and energized. And I would be in the deal. I would always come in to cut the deal. Here's what the membership is. If we're talking to the administration, here's what we want. Here's how we want it. Here's what we want. I would cut the deal. Because if you get the first two people, these are people that the administration of white folks said, damn, we can't deal with that. You're, whoa, whoa, whoa. You know? So I'd come along with the guy to cut the deal. So that's how we approached it. That's how we strategized on moving forward with the Black Student Union. And we got a lot of response from the students from that. But that was Earl's last year and Bob Blanford's last year and Josie's. So it was me and Woody going forward and a few other kids that we had developed under us to take the Black Student Union forward in the next school year. Keep going.
Well, I do have a question. I wanted to know how, once you changed the name, was there any pushback from, because, CORE could be very integrated in terms of membership. Was there any pushback with the name change? I'm thinking about when SNCC had that change where they took on a more Black power element, and it had the implications that just still reverberate. I wonder about how the people who had already been in CORE felt about the name change. Did you have any pushback?
Yeah, some of them didn't like that because they liked the fact that the white folks, white students were also in the room with us at the time that we were talking about CORE. They were in the room. So anything we talked about, they shared in that information. They were on the committees and yada, yada, yada. But we knew the new core of Black people outnumbered that. Mm-hmm. And it was not a problem to us of getting the whites out. Some white kids would come back, came back to us and ask, what can I do? I want to be a part of it. And I said, you can't be a part of this. You know, you can continue with a core type relationship where you can join your own thing, but we've got to do this thing ourselves. You can support us. And that did happen. And I don't see how that happened. Earl will tell you how he had to fight to get recognition for CORE on campus. Mm-hmm. The Black Student Union recognition was darn near going to be impossible, because here it is, Black Student Union. That sounds militant student union. Panthers, what are you guys? So, you know, we understood that. We did a lot of planning, a lot of strategizing. So I was doing the summer after all that, Blanford left and Josie, during the summer, I started planning with Woody the things and how we were going to do it. First of all, see, Earl didn't, they didn't recognize CORE on campus. He got no student, you know, all organizations on campus get, you know, part of the student council, student administration, you get funds, you get this and that, yada, yada. He didn't get any of that. I said, okay, fine. I know we're not going to get that. But see, what the administration did not understand that if there weren't that many Black students out there, but there were a lot of Black employees out there. Mm-hmm. There were more Black employees than there were Black professors and anybody else. And they supported us because they wanted their kids to go there. They saw what we were doing. They saw what was going on because they were in the room. So we needed an office, and we didn't have an office. And they weren't going to give us an office. They did. They told us what they weren't going to recognize us as a part of an organization on campus. So one of the janitors at the student union said, "Hey, look, you know, it's on this street." That he showed us a room under the stairs in the student union building on the main street when you walk in the door. And when you walk in the room, I mean, it's a big room. It's like a storeroom. But it's not real big, you know, it's maybe a size of a garage or something like that. And you said, "We can clean this stuff out here. You guys, you know, don't say nothing to me, but, you know, don't mention my name." But, you know, so we took over that space, moved some desks out there. They got us some desks we found that was left outside of one of the administration buildings. We took the desk, put them in there, set up an office, put a sign on the door, Black Student Union. Now, to my amazement, that building next door to that, beautiful. And when I saw that, I said, "Oh my God, what has happened in this transition?" Mm-hmm. We took that. And I wanted to get recognition for the Black Student Union on campus. So we have to go through the student council in order to get that. And they were not in favor of that. Except there was this one girl, this young white Jewish girl that was vice president. I can't think of her name, Susan somebody. Mm-hmm. And she was one of those that liked the CORE stuff. And she had said, "What can I do?" So I said, "Susan, here's what you can do. You can get us, you can nominate us. You can put us in there. We want to be in it." So the Black Student Union was invited in to join. I was the first Black president of any organization to go. There's a president's retreat of organization that goes to, what's this place across the bridge, every year. And I went on that for the weekend. And the university vehicles stayed in the university. It's a university facility. It's on a big farm resort. And she did that. They got that. We got that in there. And so that's how I wanted to try to move things, organize things, put things in place, and do as much as I can, you know, because, you know, this whole Black movement was moving across the United States, and a lot of the universities were getting afraid as to what was going to happen to their school, if they had, especially those that had any number of Black population. And University of Maryland, College Park campus, getting more African-Americans in. And that's what they were more concerned about. So they brought this special student advisor and administrator in, a guy by the name of Martin. I think it's Jay Martin. And his major purpose was to make sure, you know, Blacks, that there's no student interruption, especially with the Blacks. And there's this student nonviolent, there's this white group that was more dangerous than we were. You know, they, student non, what is they calling it? It'll come to me.
For Democratic Society?
Yeah. Those guys. Okay, they're up there giving a speech, routing stuff out. I'm walking past going to one of the rare classes that I went to, because most of the time I was in somebody's meeting or somewhere. And they're up there spilling. I'm just listening to them, just standing there listening to them. And this state trooper comes over to me and says, "Mr. McLeod, if there is any trouble, are you going to be willing to go peacefully?" I said, "This is not my meeting. I have nothing to do with these guys. These guys are saying everything. Let's take over and let's destroy." And they come to me, want to take, seeing if I want to go peacefully. See, their concern is not the white kids. They weren't going to beat them, but they were going to beat us if we try to do anything at all. We know that. And University of Maryland certainly didn't want any problems on their campus. So they brought this guy in. And I found out that that's really what his purpose was. And so we were going to, you know, use that as best as possible for what we wanted. What we decided to do, we decided to have a list of demands. And what we wanted were Black professors, a Black student, a Black history program. We wanted a Black facility, a Black facilities. We want to participate in all of this and everything. We want the campus open to all Blacks, because there was this one neighborhood that was near the University of Maryland where they would not, was a poor Black neighborhood. They would, if you came from there, you were not going to go to the University of Maryland, period. For some reason, there was just that racial stigma placed on that community. We wanted that removed. We wanted tutoring programs to be paid to go out there.
Do you remember the name of the community?
I can ask Earl. I'll ask Earl and I'll text it to you.
Okay.
Yeah, right. I drove past here a few weeks ago and it looks like that they've all been developed out now. But I'll ask them.
It's Lakeland.
That sounds familiar.
Okay. Well, yeah, that's
It's you know where the engineering building is?
Mm-hmm.
Across US-1. It's across from there, back over. There used to be like a railroad dump over in that area. Mm-hmm. But I'll find the name out.
Okay.
So, you know, that's how we were pushing. And most of my time was spent not in class, but in the administration office, because they wanted to manage me and manage the Black kids. But they were really screwing me because I wasn't studying. I was supposed to be a student. But we knew this because we understood what the progression of activity across the United States was in the Black African community on this. And we saw how the universities and colleges were handling it. We studied how the white colleges were handling it. So when we saw this guy come in, we knew what was going to happen. And so, you know, that was going on good. They were negotiating all this and that and everything. Then there was, I think it was the Home Economics Department had a study, and mm-hmm. four Black girls were rejected because of their DNA or something, but they didn't think that their genetics was compatible or something for the study. And they came to me and we talked about it, and we had some of our students go research, find out what was going on. And they came back. So when we found out what was going on, we decided to send one more test person in there, because we made a little objection. We sent one more test person in there, and we told her to get in that, see if she can get an application. She would get rejected. They accepted the application. they cautioned her about if she's going to be able to be a part of it because of this DNA, the design, yada, yada, yada. This was the thing that really got the students on campus really fired up, because it was something that hit right at home that, yeah, we like you, we want you, but you really are different. You know, we really don't accept you, and here's why, because you're genetically not as good as us. That's what it was saying, period. And so that hit the Black students hard. That hit the dark Blacks, the half Blacks, the Blacks trying to pass everybody. That's in bottom line, you're still a nigger. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're going to keep you in your place. We're going to manage you. So this thing, when that hit hard. We saw an opportunity to take advantage of it. And we went and we protested hard. The students came around and joined us. I mean, it was a mass thing. And it got bigger. It's like 500,000, 600,000 Black kids out there. And the university shook. Mm-hmm. Because all around the United States, the Black schools, Blacks on white campuses, and the Whites on white campuses were disrupting, burning, protesting, and everything else. We had a lot in our group that wanted to do the same thing. And I had to push back on that. And there was a lot of anger, you know, in that response, in my response to them, because they wanted to do that, because they just wanted to be a part of that. And that's fine. You know, go stab somebody, shoot somebody, blow up somebody, burn somebody. You know, what does that get you at the end of the day? Nothing. At best, worse off, you know, from my point of view. So, but they wanted to do that, but I would push back. And for that, you know, I was called controlling and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But I had a plan. So I organized the kids. We got in front of the home ec building, and we were going to go in the building. We were going to disrupt the building. But the group we had met the night before, it was under control. We're going to follow my plan. Martin, the vice president, came out, and, you know, they had all of the police and everybody else right there in front of the building going to keep us out. And he said, Bobby, can I talk to you? I said, fine, let's talk. So there's a picture of him and I, the Diamondback took, he and I talking, trying to make a contract, a deal. And he didn't want us to come in the building. And I said, look, I've got 500-600 students out there. We're going to come in the building, but here's what I can do. We can come in the building. We can just walk around, look around, and there won't be any disruption to anything. And our protests can be managed, but the administration's got to give us something. They got to give us a Black student on the board that selects professors. We want to be a part. We want more Black professors. We want all of these things. We want to be in the decision-making on all of these things. And, you know, he went back and talked about, I guess, that dean or college president, and came back and he said, okay, we have a deal. I said, but look, you know, if you ever don't do this, I can't tell you what's not going to happen. I'll go back and tell my folks that we have a deal and we're going to be a part of everything in this university. And we're going to get Black professors. We're going to get more Black people in. We're going to get all of these things. You know, we're going to sit on the decision-making of boards and positions everywhere. And if you don't do that, then not only am I in trouble, but I can't control anything that's going to happen. So they did that. They committed to that. And if you'll notice, the university, if you check the records, University of Maryland was one of the only majority schools that did not have a Black disruption ever, because the Blacks at the University of Maryland sat on those positions. They were in those positions. They made decisions. Young students, if you check, there's a book, Woody, Higher Education Stories. I don't know if you've seen this or read this.
I haven't, but I'm writing it down.
I can send you a copy. I'll send you a photocopy of the page. Okay. And there's a section here. The guy that was the took over from me, Haywood Woody Farrar. He has chapter 5, prying open the door further. A memoir of the Black student protest at the University of Maryland from 1966 to 1970. And he talks about how there was never any type of violent Black activity at the University of Maryland. And you see all these things that are going on there at the University of Maryland, and I see Black students running around and everything. And I'm happy that all that's happening, but they should know how it got to be that way. You know, it's a lot of people like Earl and people before Earl and people like me and people after me did a lot of stuff in order to make that happen. You know, like I said, I was in what I call business meetings all that time. And my grades were like shit, excuse the expression. But even at that, I received a letter from Harvard that, you know, when I graduated from Maryland, they wanted me to come to their business school. They hadn't seen a grade because I didn't have any goddamn grades. But because of the activity with the Black Student Union, Harvard was trying to recruit Blacks all around the United States because they wanted Black leaders, Black Harvard trained leaders. And a few of my buddies that I know now were a part of that grabbing of Harvard of the Black talent. But I couldn't take the offer because, you know, first of all, my grades were like shit. And I was, I had to leave the university because my girlfriend got pregnant and that became a priority. So Woody and I sat down and we talked about everything and about what he wanted to do, what had been started. And Woody was a smart guy, very smart guy. I think he got his PhD. And that was the kind of Black guy we needed to take over because there was not going to be any revolutionists there to fight anything. There just had to be a person there that just saw things in a programmatic kind of way to follow through with what they committed that they would do. And he did a perfect job. He did a perfect job. You know, he thought I was a little too strong arm, but hell, that's what I had to be. You know, that's just how it is. But I think what happened after that was phenomenal and fantastic. I don't know all the details because I had to develop a career as a result of being the Black Student Union doing at the University of Maryland. He got me a job on this Black newspaper. That got me a job as a director, as a community organization, one of the largest ones in DC. And hell, I wasn't even but 21 years old, you know. And from there, you know, got me to one of the largest international economic consulting firms, had a presidential appointment with the U.S. Department of Commerce. Helped set up Bombay Office of Minority Business Enterprise. You know, so I've done, you know, well, I've been in business for some 40, I guess I'd say 40 years now. I can see they've copped that resume. I don't have to go through all of that. But it's been, you know, I've used my skills to the best of my abilities. And I've used the opportunities that are presented to me in the best of my abilities. And I've always worked for my family, my immediate family, and my larger family. I've learned a lot in the white society and white community. I've learned a lot from them. I've learned a lot of them. I've learned a lot about life. And I use that and I bring that back to us. To negotiate and deal with them and to better us as well. I'm going to send you something. I set up the spring water store. Was the first African-American. It was the only spring water store in the United States. And I was only the only African American in the Springwater business at that time. Been in that business for around 35 years. We're setting up a company called Home Grower Inc., which is a cannabis company. Well, I say we, I am. It's a cannabis company. We have a patent on a process that we're doing. I'll send you information on that.
Okay.
We have another company called Legacy Nation, which is provides, it's a 501c3, provides training. We raise funds to provide training for individuals that want to be in the cannabis industry, own in the cannabis industry. And the home grower itself, we provides an opportunity for the small person to own a cannabis operation, part of ours, and be a part of the revenue stream, not just a part of the market, being a market, you know, target. So, you know, that's what I've been doing. That's what, and Earl's been moving in the same direction. We've got that type of thing in our blood, and that's how we roll. Bob Lanford the same way. I wish I, and I'm sure if I could find it with Josie, she's probably fighting some civil rights thing somewhere. That's about it. Woody died, so you're not going to be able to talk to him, but you, there's a lot in this book, and it gives you names that you might be able to follow through on. I don't know some of those people.
Okay, so Woody is Howard Farrar?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's chapter 5. Hayward, H-A-Y-W-A-R-D.
H-A-Y.
Woody.
Okay.
Hayward, Woody, Farrar, F-A-R-R-A-R.
Okay.
He was vice president under me. And when I left, I put him in the slot.
Okay. And what year did you leave Maryland? And when you left, did you leave or did you graduate?
I did not graduate. I left in 69.
Okay.
My first daughter was born in 69. I married a girl from the University of Maryland, Plum Grant. And that's Tracy's mother.
Is that so?
Yeah.
I say that because that's on my list of people I was trying to find.
Plum Grant? Well, I told her. Well, there was a news, some news people from the Diamondback contacted us, wanted to do something. She didn't want to talk to them. She might talk to you.
I hope so.
Did you have her contact information?
No, I couldn't find her.
Well, I got it.
Okay.
But I have to contact her first to find
right,
out.
Right, absolutely.
Who else do you want to try to reach?
Oh, goodness. I have... Let me find my thing here. William Linton. He would have been before your time.
That would have been. Earl might know him.
And Daryl Hill, he's emailed me back already.
Yeah.
Let me see from your town. Daryl Jones has contacted me. But I do hold on one second. Let me pull up
the list.
Here we go. And so what the way I was doing it was that there were so few people in the early 60s, I was looking for every Black graduate because the number of people was so small. Brenda Hull, I think her last name is Thompson now. Arnita Hicks.
Plum and Earl might know them. And there's another person called Trina Taylor. You might want to talk to her. You see, with the most of
oh, I think we froze. Oh no.
Black kids that were allowed in came from one or two schools, two black okay. schools, and they all know each other. So if you find one, you're going to find the rest of them.
Okay. Okay.
And Earl and Trina went to one or two of those schools. I think Plum, she was living in Dundalk, Maryland. And I don't know how she got there. I know her father was working the steel mills. Mm-hmm. And she was on scholarship. So, you know, when I dropped out, I couldn't pay for my schooling anymore, certainly. But I had to work for the baby and the family. But she continued to go to school because she had her father's, she was looking for her father's, some type of her father's pension death was paying for the university. So a lot of the black students knew each other from different schools. It wasn't like they came from different areas.
All over the place.
Yeah.
There was okay. clusters. Mm-hmm. I do have a few other questions for you. When you attended UMD, did you live on campus or off campus?
I lived on campus, except for the last 6 months. I lived off campus. Matter of fact, with Earl and Blanford on Rhode Island Avenue.
Okay. So we've discussed your involvement in CORE and the Black Student Union. Were you involved in doing that work? Did it have you involved in the outside community? Any? Were you involved in any organizations outside of UMD?
No.
Okay.
No, we were totally focused. You know, I don't think Earl and Blanford were either. We were totally focused.
Okay, so I'm going to ask.
Their answer might be different. I have to speak for me.
I'm going to ask you a question that may seem counterintuitive, but I'm really interested in. We've talked about what the Black Student Union was doing, but I'm interested in what were students experiencing that pushed them to that point. So, if you could talk to me about race relations during your time at UMD, what were students experiencing in class and the dorms, that kind of thing.
Well, see, this is why I want you to, I think Plum's perspective and Trina's perspective is important. But for this news article, what I found out from them was that whatever happened was so traumatic, they don't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
They want to forget it. And even Earl wanted to forget it. He did not want to talk about it. He did not. But I just think that it's so important to what you're doing, to the history of this school, to these black kids and these black professors that are out there to know what the hell happened. It's just important for them to know. And I'm happy that they're enjoying this. But thank God, you gotta understand something. This wasn't because of kindness of this school or this gen or these white folks. This was blood, sweat, and tears going down here. And if you can get them to talk, that you might find out some things. Because see, I like it's in South Dakota, I was on a different kind of level. I didn't eat with the kids in South Dakota because we had a football table. Now, so I don't know what happened. You know, at the University of Maryland, I hung with four people. We talked about one thing. If we went, we might go to a party. We had an apartment, so most of the parties came to us. So I didn't involve anything else, and I hadn't really no other life. I didn't even study, you know. So other folks may know that. I gave you the name of Ken Holliday. Mm-hmm. He's another person that you may need to talk to. He was one of the first black students in the drama department of significance that came out. He might have some influence on that, but I don't. You know, you might ask Earl, he'd probably say the same thing I'm saying.
Okay.
And another thing was all of the professors treated, well, they knew who we were.
Mm-hmm.
And so they treated us different, you know. You know, I got an F just like I deserved, but, you know, it was with some consciousness that was given. Matter of fact, there was this one class I was taking, the math, because in business you have to take 6 hours of them, math. And, oh, God, I hated this class. It was over in the engineering building. And you would walk in and this music was playing. I had these screens up and you were going to watch this guy. And I was just crazy. And, but there was the graduate student or whoever, the associate that was in the room, they knew where I was. So when I took the test, I just filled it. I said, I don't know. I just really don't know. And I got a C and it said, for the good of the public. And that thing stuck with me. He put it in Latin for un publicio, whatever. But I translated it, said for the good of the public. And that meant a lot. That this was a white person saying, hey, we know who you are. And it might be important that you stay here to do this or something like that. Like I said, there are a lot of things that people did or that I saw that I benefited from that motivated me to do whatever. And so, that's the kind of involvement that I had. What this guy, Martin, did, he made a deal with a young man, young black man, that went on for the rest of that university's existence today for blacks. And it's remarkable across the United States. He didn't have to do that. I made the hardest goddamn demands I could think of. We gave him a list, and I can't remember all what they were. But he came back and said, okay. And then we had to follow through. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Other than possibly the BSU office, do you remember any physical spaces on campus buildings or spots on campus that you really felt welcome in?
No, we were not allowed, we weren't a part of the fraternities, sorority society. Some of our students in the latter parts of my time there were trying to get in and they were rejected. So that fight had started. Also the fight to try to bring on a black sorority of fraternity. Sports in the sports arenas, we were okay. In the academic side, we were not. In the social side, we were not. And the even in the medical treatment side, we were not. Black, it was that may have changed a lot after I left there, but while we were there, that's the way it was. Hey, and we didn't think that was fine with us, but we want to make that work for us, mm-hmm. We began to get more prominent in terms of what we were doing in recognition, and that Black experience across the United States began to gel and come out more. A lot of the Black white students opened up and saw an opportunity, that we should support this group because basically they're like, we're trying to get what they're trying to get. We're trying to get recognition. And all of the splinter groups started to come up, the Hispanic, and the Chinese. I saw the beginning of all of that. But, those are the only places where.
When you say the medical treatment side, you didn't feel welcome. Do you mean that in places where you got medical treatment, you felt racism occurring in those spaces?
Yeah, I mean, those of us that had a problem that could would go home, go ask somebody's mama. Earl became a family member of my parents' house on Jefferson Street. It's just the whole environment just didn't make you feel comfortable. And before we started Black Student Union, you just you know, you just didn't ruffle the feathers. You know? But after we started, we knew that there was going to be some problems. And the school was still, hold on a second. You know, after we started, the racism was still there, institutional racism was still there. And we were fighting that. It was changing, but we were fighting that. So, no, and that the medical side was the race. I mean, you sit there for an hour before you got treated, you know? Other kids would be coming in and out of there. I mean, the kids, especially the girls, would be complaining about that to us. We heard all those complaints.
Okay. So I attended the Black Perspective event towards the end of the fall of last year. So it made me think, at what point did alum or even the institution start to ask you about your experiences and invite you back?
Let me tell you something. I'm out shamed and embarrassed for them for this. That around three, four years ago, I got a contact from one of the class presidents of the Black Student Union, and they asked me and Earl and Blanford to come out to speak. Blanford and I showed up, and we just had a wonderful time with them. But before that, nothing. No thank yous, no nothing. I mean, buildings go up, people are becoming Black president of the University of Maryland, and nobody says, thank you, dogs, for digging this hole, for digging this for me, you know, nothing. But hey, okay, no problem. That's the way life is, you know. But I think that it should be chronicled somewhere that this is was the undertow of what happened. I mean, you know. I'm glad for that. I think it should be that. That's the righteous thing. It should be the way it is now. Like, come on. And guys like Earl, it is amazing. It's amazing. You know, when you talk to him, you'll see.
Okay. I'm hoping I get a chance to talk to him.
I'm going to talk to him heavy. He's stubborn as hell. But I'm trying to bring him around. Let me tell you something about Earl that you may not tell you, but I'm going to tell you and stop the recording for a second. On this.
Okay.
Can you start it again?
Yeah, I'll be able to start it again. Okay, we're back.
The reality at the University of Maryland during that time of the new Black Revolution and revolutionary, I can't tell you that I had control of everybody. When we would go into a meeting with the administration, I told them I represented every Black person on campus. They didn't know that, you know, but I told them that. But they feared that. And that's what I wanted. And that was fine. But the reality is that there were some Blacks on campus that wanted to and tried to bring us things that they would get as a result of following examples of other revolutionaries. Mm-hmm. I know one group robbed a bank. I said, listen, I'm not a part of that. We don't want to be a part of that. Whatever you got, keep it over there. And listen, I don't want to know any names, but that we would put on, we'd have Black dances and we would sponsor things like that. Now some people just wanted to do some criminal element things, but I just kept it out. I just kept it out because we had a good thing going. We didn't need that. If you wanted to go that route, you know, you have to go someplace else or get your own organization, call it something else. But that was a problem. I would imagine that, you know, just like when a police officer asked me if I was going to go peacefully, because he thought I was going to be, if I was involved in something. That also tells us that, you know, because of who we are we become targets. You know, Earl's name is not a name that's going to go away in some people's memory and some people's records. You know, my name is not either. And I know that a lot of times when I went up against some things, I could tell when that influence of the Black Student Union or my other activities have pointed to a negative response because of this or that. And I've taken a lot of stances in business with the government for the purpose of the African-American community. Some people don't like that. IRS doesn't like that. The SBA doesn't like it when they go. I was recruited to be a part of help organize the Office of Minority Business Enterprise under Nixon and a guy named John Jenkins, who he appointed to run the Office of Minority Business Enterprise, which is a part of the Commerce Department. Mm-hmm. And they knew who I was. I mean, they needed a Black guy in there to help because there was Omri was developing down and they didn't have any Blacks on the top to talk to and work with the cities and states to set up these Office of Minority Business Enterprise. You know, the things that I would propose would be completely appropriate, I would think, for bringing minority businesses in. A lot of people didn't like that, but, you know, so those kinds of things go against you. So I understand that.
I definitely understand that. Because that's something too, right? I think that's why I really believe in doing interviews like this and conducting oral history interviews and making sure they get deposited, because there was a very real price for the organizing and activism your generation did for my generation and for generations after me. And maybe you don't see it so much because it looks like they've just disappeared off the history page, right? You're flipping through the book, you learn about the student activism in the 60s, you flip the page, it's now 1980 and other stuff is happening, right? I've always wondered, well, what happened to that person? So I think that's important. And also to think about the like long reaching implications of devoting yourself in that way to things that matter to you. And I would think that because you're in college, which is where this is supposed to be your on-ramp to all the financial and social, to all the things, right? And they terrify you going into college that if you don't walk right, talk right, you know, behave in a particular way, your future is dead, yeah. Right? So it's always been important to me to follow up with campus leaders, campus organizers, or really to meet brave people to find out what happened, what did happen. Because like you said, there were definite forces working against your success.
Yeah.
That's clear. Like when you think about maybe COINTELPRO, right? Are you familiar with COINTELPRO? Probably, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I wonder if programs like that ever stop, you know, when I think about current student activists. So I think it's important maybe for a new generation of organizers and activists, agitators, if you will, to learn how another, a prior generation survived it.
Right.
Yeah. Or if they survived it. So I think that's why I think that's one of the things I think is the importance of a project like this.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think too that the fight that we had is different from the fights going on today. And I'm not saying that ours was is or was more important than what's happening now. Mm-hmm. It's just that it's a different fight on a different level, but it's the same fight. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the same thing going on. And I respect what's going on. You know, it's my fault. I don't know what's going on and a lot of it. Mm-hmm. And so I can't blame those that's in today. Not knowing all of us in the back, because you know I don't know all that's going on, so I cannot blame you for not knowing all of what we've been in the back. But it's the same fight. I see that. You know, it's the same thing going on. The grainy thing that at the bottom is the same damn thing. And I respect the way that folks are fighting today. It's a different fight on a different level. It moves fast, quick. And but hey, you know, we can all learn from one another.
Absolutely.
As long as it keeps going on and we win.
Would it be okay if I email you after this interview to remind you of the names you mentioned, that if you have any possible contact information? And I totally understand you needing to contact them first to see if it's okay to put them in contact with me.
Yeah, I'll try to talk them into it, you know, convince them. You know, the person that did the interview for the Diamondback was a Brazilian person, white face. Maybe I'm going to show them your picture and your face and your poster and all that. So maybe they'll talk. I don't know. You know, I really would like to hear to the bottom of what happened, say, with Plum and Trina and the rest of the girls. I mean, Trina, I know, went out for the cheerleaders. And I don't think she made it. I don't know. It's a lot of stuff, a lot of things. I mean, it's not because we were Black, we didn't do what the school activities were. Everything, I think somebody tried to do some of everything that was going on. But the reasons why they didn't make it might be interesting to know.
And if there's anything, any information, because in my prior oral history projects, I've definitely had folk ask for things to just, you know, there's a vetting process in the Black community. So if there's information they want, if they want my picture, if they want my credentials, I'm willing to provide anything. So.
All right, I'll try my best.
All right, so I think that is it for now. We're gonna go ahead and end this interview. And I just wanna thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to talk to me. I enjoyed this talk just as much as I enjoyed watching the Black Perspective panel that you were on. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I really appreciated the multi-decade way that they allowed you all to be in conversation. I thought that was important.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much for doing this. I think it's a very, very important thing that you're doing, and I really appreciate it. So thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, anything I can do to help, let me know.
Okay.
And I will respond, and I'll send you a copy of the, I just took a picture of it. I'll send it over to you. I can send it over by text. That's fine.
Okay. Thank you.
I don't have
email.
Do I have my email? Mm-hmm. Email. That's fine. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.